Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. On this weekend, 155 years ago, there were two important events involving Vermont and the Civil War. In fact, they happened within hours of each other, even though they were hundreds of miles apart. The first was a well-planned-out Confederate raid in St. Albans, where banks were robbed and there was gunfire in the downtown area. The second was a pivotal battle known as the Battle of Cedar Creek, where Vermont troops played a critical role in the outcome of the Union victory. Well, what happened at these events, and why are they part of Vermont's Civil War history? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. Howard, it's always great to have you on the program.
Wonderful to be back, Bob.
So, Howard, let's start off talking about the raid in St. Albans. Take us back to October of 1864. Most of the action in the Civil War is taking place in Virginia and some other southern states, but Vermont Governor John Gregory Smith has this concern about being attacked from Canada. Why does he have that concern?
Well, you know, Bob, I'm not exactly sure where that concern came from. Of course, he is a St. Albans resident. He addresses the legislature when it convenes and warns them that he thinks there's a chance of a Confederate raid. My suspicion is, you know, Smith was a railroad man. He was a railroad magnate. And the railroad people were always passing concerns back and forth. And I think that somebody in the railroad circles may have picked up some information. Of course, the Confederates at that time had a strategy to try to raise the Dickens along the international border, the Canadian border, so that we would divert troops up here. And St. Albans was part of that strategy.
So are people in St. Albans a little on edge?
Not that I can determine. Business is pretty much as usual. It's a busy town, you know. It's a railroad town. People come and go by the hundreds every day, you know. And these Confederates that came into town over the course of a week were making comments, some of them. You know, somebody said he was, I'm Jefferson Davis, when the clerk asked him. And another one said, you know, I'm here, we're here to do in your town, and then laughed, you know. But so many people coming and going, and it was wartime, and nobody paid any attention.
You know, I find it fascinating that these Confederate troops come to St. Albans, as you mentioned, over the course of the week. Some of them come on the train. It's not like these guys are sneaking into town and don't want to be seen. They're on the train. They get off the train in St. Albans. They go to the boarding house. And as you just said, they say, well, you know, what are you doing here? Hey, I'm here to blow up the town. People must have thought this was a big joke.
Oh, well, yes, I suppose there was that kind of banter, you know. It was wartime. Their leader, Bennett Young, who was a Kentuckian, had escaped from a prison out in Ohio, and he made his way through Canada down to St. Albans. And he portrayed himself in the week before the raid as a theology student. And he rode around the countryside on horseback reading his Bible. Of course, he was looking over the landscape, looking for escape routes, looking for horses they could use. He even went up and visited Mrs. Smith, and she showed him her fine stable of horses.
No kidding.
Yes.
And are they here mostly to rob the banks? Is that what they want to do?
They're here to rob the banks. They're here to rob the banks, but they're also here to burn the town to the ground. This is serious business. This is warfare. They had grenades with them called Greek fire grenades. They were supposed to start a fire on impact, but lucky for St. Albans, they didn't work very well, and it was a wet day. And these things fizzled. They smoked a lot, but they wanted to burn the town.
And this wasn't some crazy plot by a bunch of disgruntled people. This was pretty well thought out at the highest levels of the Confederacy, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It's almost certain it was approved by Jefferson Davis. And it was part of the Northern strategy to raise the Dickens on the border. And it another event in this strategy well may have been the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. John Wilkes Booth made a couple of trips to Montreal before the assassination through St. Albans to meet with Canadians, Confederates up there to discuss the strategy. There's a close tie between St. Albans and the assassination.
Was he trying to get some financing for his plan at that point?
Was Booth?
Yeah.
He was a well-to-do person. He didn't need it, really. We don't know exactly what he was talking about. Maybe he was talking about the St. Albans raid. We don't know.
So this raid starts, and as you mentioned, Bennett Young being the person who is the leader of this group, he goes on Main Street and says, I'm here in the name of the Confederacy, and what's the reaction to this?
Well, people thought he was crazy. He had on a Confederate uniform, but Young said that all his men, there are about 20 of them, all his men had at least some piece of a Confederate uniform on, which became important in their trial later on, because if they had been out of uniform totally, they were more apt to be hanged. But no, he announces that he's taking over the town for the Confederacy, and one guy riding by him on a wagon just makes some remark, you're crazy. You know, but they pretty quick found out when they bust into the banks with drawn pistols, and they say, we are doing these things in retaliation for what Sheridan is doing in the Shenandoah Valley. Close link between the fighting in the Shenandoah, Cedar Creek, Winchester, and St. Albans.
Let's talk to Peter, who's calling from Brattleboro. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Hi. So I heard recently, you basically answered my question before I was able to ask it, and that was I had heard that there was some connection with Canada and the Civil War, and I just could not believe it. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, there was this cell of Confederates located in Montreal, and that's why Bennett Young went to Montreal when he escaped from prison. He knew he'd have supporters there, and they put him on a boat down the coast, and he goes to Richmond to talk about this raid with higher-ups in the Confederate government. So there's an active cell up there. But we don't know a great deal about it. There was a Confederate man who was in charge of the Northern strategy that spent most of his time in Montreal. But a lot of the names we don't know. We don't know where they met. It's a mystery.
Peter, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's turn to Chris in Shelburne. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hello. How are you?
Doing great.
Good. Hey, my great grandfather was in the Civil War, Robinson Templeton, and I know he was a lieutenant. My cousin has his dress sword in Montpelier, but I'm not sure. Does that name ring a bell to you, sir?
I'm sorry, it doesn't, but I could look it up closely with my directory. Go online, Howard Coffin Civil War, if you want to contact me, and we'll find him.
All right, Chris, maybe we'll find out some more about your family and the Civil War. We appreciate your phone call.
There certainly was a good chance his ancestor was at Cedar Creek, because it was the battle that involved the most Vermont units of any battle in the Civil War. We're getting a little ahead of ourselves here.
So let's just go back to the idea of the raid in St. Albans and Bennett Young saying he's ready to declare St. Albans as part of the Confederacy. How do people react? How does this unfold from there?
Well, first of all, I think this is some kind of a crazy stunt, some foolishness. But then a couple of fights break out. Some shots are fired. And a couple of people get slugged. And suddenly they realize that there is something going on here. The Confederates are here. One of the people on the street was Captain George Conger, a cavalryman home on leave. And Young spots him immediately, sees his military bearing, and he puts him under guard, but he escapes by running into a hotel and out the back door, and he runs home, gets his pistol, and forms a posse. So they're going to be pursued, those Confederates, when they leave town. No, it prickly turned from what looked like some kind of a comic fiasco into very, very serious business.
And then, as we mentioned earlier, robbing the banks is a top priority, and they go ahead and do that, don't they?
They certainly do. They got $280,000. That's a lot of money in those days, although there was a lot more around. They missed some gold coins in one bank that would probably up that total by $50,000 to $100,000. The bankers were Yankee in their approach to money, and they did the best they could to keep it for themselves or for the North.
So after they robbed the banks, do they decide we better get some horses and get out of here?
They certainly do. While the raid is in progress, Young and a couple of his compatriots are stealing horses from the livery stable. It's because of one of these thefts that the only man to get killed in the raid takes a bullet, Elnius Morrison from New Hampshire. He was in town building a hotel, and he came out on the sidewalk to see what was going on. And he was right in the middle of a horse thieving, and he just got in the way of a bullet. Incidentally, I was up in St. Albans leading a tour for Norwich University's 200th birthday last fall, and I think on a building on Main Street in St. Albans, I saw bullet marks. This is the first time I've seen them. I'm not going to tell anybody where they are yet, but it really looks like them. They're in a place where they would have been firing, and that's a well-preserved battlefield up there.
What do they look like? What caught your attention about that?
Nicks and bricks, we will say.
Uh-huh.
I'll never forget this experience that bound me to the Civil War was going to a church in Virginia and seeing bullet holes in it in 1967. And I was hooked for life on the Civil War. I guess I already was by then, but I think maybe we've got them in St. Albans. We'll find out.
Love to know what you discover there. You have to keep us up to date about
Absolutely.
What you find. So these guys cause havoc, rob banks, steal horses. Hey, it's time to get out of town. Is their goal now, let's make it back to Canada?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they don't take the most direct route back to Canada because they're afraid, you know, there were telegraphs around, you know, that the border would be watched right up along in the Swanton area. So they swing over to Sheldon, plus there's another bank in Sheldon. And they decide to rob that one too, but they get there too late, it's closed. So they'd have had quite a lot more money. A man up that way, two or three years ago, found some Confederate cartridges on the site of that old bank. I mean, things are coming to light all the time. Yeah, they escape to Canada, crossing the Missisquoi just north of Sheldon, and make it into Canada. And the next morning, Conger's posse captures half of them, tries to bring them back to St. Albans for hanging, and the British authorities intervene and don't let them be extradited.
They end up having a trial in Canada, don't they?
Yes, an extradition trial. The question is, will they be brought back to the United States and tried as spies? And a very sympathetic Canadian magistrate prevents that, yes.
So they're ultimately free?
They're ultimately free, yes, absolutely, yes. They get away with it, although some of them are captured again and put on trial in Ottawa, I believe. But they are also let off there, too. They get away with it. You know, Bennett Young became one of the great heroes of the Civil War in the South. After the Civil War, there was a big parade in one of the big Southern cities. I think it was Memphis. And the star of the show was to be the widow of Thomas Jonathan Jackson, Stonewall Jackson. And when this long procession came by, oh, Anna Jackson got wild applause, but the loudest applause in the parade was reserved for Bennett Young. A great Southern hero. Still is.
Why do you think that was the case?
things were going bad for the Confederacy in the fall of 1864. They were getting beat at Petersburg. They had lost at Winchester in the Shenandoah Valley and Tom's Brook and Fisher's Hill. And they needed a boost, and they got one from Bennett Young with the raid on St. Albans. They loved it.
And what's the feeling in St. Albans after the raid? Are people thinking, whoa, there might be another one, or are they not that concerned?
Well, the rumor mill just goes crazy. There are reports coming in of a raid on Plattsburgh across the lake. Of course, that never happened at all. Yes, people are fearful that there's going to be another one. They're afraid all across Vermont's northern border, northern New Hampshire, northern Maine. Finally, the governor brings up George Stannard, the hero of Gettysburg, the Vermont hero of Gettysburg, to take command of the border defenses. And with a lot of old soldiers and men recovering from their wounds, he takes control of the border. And if they had tried to raid again, they would have had a tough time getting to St. Albans or Newport or wherever. Yeah.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. As we just heard on this weekend, 155 years ago, Confederate soldiers conducted a raid in St. Albans. And just hours later, on the very same day, Vermont troops played a critical role at the Battle of Cedar Creek. And with us today to look at these stories is Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. Howard, in the summer of 1864, the Civil War has been raging for 4 years, and this is a whole lot longer than a lot of people thought. There were people who thought this thing was going to be over, what, in 3 to 6 months? But in the fall of 1864, why does the Shenandoah Valley become such an area of strategic importance?
Well, really for two reasons. Robert E. Lee's big Army of Northern Virginia is bottled up at Petersburg, Virginia. They're under siege there by Ulysses Grant. They're getting a good share of their supplies, of their foodstuff, from the Shenandoah Valley, from a railroad line that leads in just north of Richmond. So it's an incredibly important supply area. The Shenandoah Valley is a farming paradise. You know, it's a wonderful place. And also, you've got the threat that's posed from the Shenandoah Valley. The Shenandoah Valley points right at Washington. And in July, a Confederate army under Jubal Early had almost gotten into Washington, stopped just before they reached the capital in a battle at a place called Fort Stevens. So it was always the threat of the Confederate Army in the valley coming in on Washington. So it was a place that Lincoln particularly wanted to win over. The Union had never been able to do it in 4 years, but this time General Grant steps in and names his great cavalry commander, Phil Sheridan, to take an army of 40,000 into the Shenandoah Valley and conquer it once and for all.
Now, we're talking about the middle of October of 1864.
Yes.
We've got a presidential election coming up in about 3 weeks.
Absolutely.
And we have a former Union commander-in-chief, George McClellan, running as the peace candidate. And at this point in mid-October of 1864, is this election up for grabs, or is it fairly certain that Lincoln's going to win?
Lincoln, in the early part of the summer of 64, thought he was going to be defeated. But then, as summer wanes, the Union armies capture Atlanta. And that is a huge step forward for the Lincoln campaign. But there's still some doubt. Sheridan now goes into the Shenandoah in September, fights his first battle on the 19th of September at Winchester, beats the Confederates, very much due to the magnificent performance of the 8th Vermont Regiment, which according to Bruce Catton, got the whole Union battle line moving in the afternoon after they hadn't really done very much. And then there's another victory 3 days later at Fisher's Hill. Sheridan burns much of the valley. Oh, those Shenandoah people still hate that. Comes back north and encamps his army behind Cedar Creek and says, see you guys. And he goes off to Washington for a meeting.
And that episode of burning all the crops, that really becomes a very emotional event in the South. I think it's called the burning.
It's called the burning in the Shenandoah Valley. And believe me, I've spent a lot of time in the valley. I'm researching, looking for sites and so forth. And many more times than once have I been hollered at by people who see that Vermont license plate and about the burning. Actually, Sheridan went a little too far.
You know, I always like to play what if with you on some of these Civil War events and facts. So let's play what if. What if George McClellan had won and become president of the United States? Would he have let the South just secede and become its own country?
Of course, we don't know for sure. I think there's probably a pretty good chance of that. And the result of that would have been that there would have been another Civil War fought. We really don't know. McClellan, toward the election, gets a little tougher on the South than he had been. But when the Union victory is announced at Cedar Creek, there's no possible chance that Lincoln will not be elected to another term. But it was a close call at Cedar Creek. There's a painting in the State House, you know,
mm-hmm.
A beautiful painting that is sort of our official Civil War memorial or unofficial Civil War memorial of the Battle of Cedar Creek. Magnificent landscape. They chose the right subject for the painting. And, well, they should, because I think that without Vermont at Cedar Creek, the Confederates win.
So let's discuss that. The beginning of the Battle of Cedar Creek does not go well for the Union forces.
Why? They're surprised. They're overwhelmed by a pre-dawn surprise attack, an ingenious move by Jubal Early. The little 8th Vermont Regiment is sent in against this overwhelming tide of Confederates, and they lose 67% of their men, the 7th highest regimental loss in all the war. I mean, I've many times been up the little hill that they went up to make their stand. There's a Vermont monument on it now, and it's quite a feeling to walk up that hill. They knew what they were going into. They don't have an awful lot of effect, I guess. They certainly maybe slowed the attack a little. But it's the 1st Vermont Brigade, the old brigade, that finally in late morning makes a stand on a hilltop where there's a cemetery. And after Jubal Early has driven the Union Army 3 miles, the Vermont Brigade stops this attack. That's the great moment at Cedar Creek for the Vermonters.
Is that where we hear this famous cry, "Don't run, men, until the Vermonters do"?
Yes, there was a New York regiment standing beside them. They were starting to give way. Their commander gets shot, and the second-in-command, Windsor French, steps in front of his men and hollers so they and the Vermonters can hear, Don't move men until the Vermonters do. You know, hold your position. And everybody stabilized, and that third Confederate attack was beaten back. I mean, wow. It was sensational. The fighting on that hill was what was known in the Civil War often as tear the sheet fighting. The musketry was so intense that it sounded like the sound you get if you tear a sheet. There was just no space between the shots. Not a lot of battles get to that point. Gettysburg, of course, Wilderness, Spotsylvania, but it was very intense there at Cedar Creek. And they stopped the Confederate attack, and then Sheridan comes back on the battlefield. He returns from Washington, organizes a counterattack, and, Bob, it's amazing. Just about the same moment that those Confederates go into the banks in St. Albans, Sheridan launches the counterattack that will sweep the Confederate army before him.
Let's talk to Penny, who is calling from Burlington. Hi, Penny. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Howard Coffin. Penny Pillsbury here.
Hi, Penny.
We're wondering... Hi there. I just am flashing back to the wonderful tour you did of St. Albans Raid for the library folks back several years ago. As I remember in your story of the escape from through Sheldon and up, there was supposedly... I think you told us about a farmer that had maybe gotten some of the money off the Raiders somehow and dug a hole behind his farmhouse or barn, and the next year built a big farm barn. Am I remembering correctly that that's what happened?
Well, we don't know exactly. There was a farmer up near the Missisquoi, just north of the Missisquoi, who had a fairly modest house. And some of his neighbors said they saw him digging in his orchard not long after the St. Albans raid. And he then built a magnificent brick house that's still there. And the neighbors all thought that some Confederates had buried some loot there and that he found it and dug it up and got himself a house. Don't know whether there's any truth to that or not. Something happened up there. The Confederates were pretty well weighted down with money. You know, a lot of it was coins. And who knows, maybe they did bury a little bit. By the way, that quotation in the Battle of Windsor French, "Don't run till the Vermonters do," was so clever because it played on the old rivalry between Vermont and New York. I wanted to clarify that. I was dancing around that quote.
Penny, thanks very much
Thank
for
you,
your
Penny.
Phone call. We really appreciate it. So what starts out as a probable Confederate victory at Cedar Creek with the surprise in the morning turns out to be a defeat for the Confederate Army. Does General Early get a lot of criticism for not following through or not sort of completing the task? Does he come under some criticism for that?
Oh, absolutely. One of his generals said that he urged him to continue the attack against the Vermonters and a couple of other brigades on that Cemetery Hill. But Early said no, and he basically said apparently, no, they're beaten. You know, I don't have to do that. But back comes Sheridan, realigns his army, and at 3 o'clock launches that counterattack, which drives the Confederate army a mile, and then the Confederates put up a heck of a defense. Looks like the battle may be a draw, and then the ground begins to shake. The Confederates feel what they think may be an earthquake. Hmm. No earthquake. 4,000 horses under Custer, including the Vermont cavalry coming down out of the northwest, and they make Cedar Creek a rout. William Wells commanding the Vermont cavalry, they set an all-time record for the Civil War, capturing more than 20 cannons. Oh, it's amazing. Of course, they did it because a bridge broke and on the Confederate retreat, and all these cannons were stacked up along the road, and they grabbed them. But still a great moment in the Civil War for a great Vermonter, William Wells.
What would have happened if the outcome of this battle had been different? Going back to our what-if game, what if the Confederates had won Cedar Creek? What would have the impact have been?
Well, look at it this way. When the fighting in the Shenandoah began, there were 40,000 soldiers in Sheridan's army, and Early had about 17,000. Both had taken a lot of casualties by the time of Cedar Creek. Even if the Confederates had won at Cedar Creek, I don't think they had a long-term chance in the valley. There were just too many Yankees. And Sheridan, you know, the army wouldn't have been destroyed. There weren't enough Confederates. So Sheridan would have got them back in shape, and he would have attacked Early again, and I think he probably would have won it. But who knows what the effect would have been on the election, because Cedar Creek certainly had a very positive effect on that election. And Lincoln, of course, won very handily. Yeah.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin has written a number of critically acclaimed books about Vermont's participation in the Civil War. He's also been doing a lot of research recently on the role of Vermont women during the war. As we've been discussing, Vermont's battlefield record is well established, as more than 35,000 Vermonters went to serve in the Union Army. But what do we know about the role of women in Vermont during that time and how they sustained the home front? This is sort of a new area of research for you, and you've been doing talks around the state on this subject.
Yes, it is a new area for me. I got into this subject in three of my books a little bit, but now I'm really piling into it, and I'm finding more and more information almost every day. Bob, at the time of the Civil War, there were 30,000 farms in Vermont. It's hard to imagine today. We got about 500. But, you know, almost 35,000 men went to war. And that left a lot of the farms, a lot of the homes, most homes were little farms, without the able-bodied men. And who was going to run the farm? Who was going to take care of everything? And it fell to the women. They even went to work in the factories. And it was tough. It was really tough. They also, in most Vermont towns of any size, met at a hall in the town in the evenings and on weekends to make things for the soldiers. Underwear, blankets, slippers, you name it. They were sending tons of stuff to help the war effort. At the same time, taking care of the kids, taking care of the farm, doing the cooking. It was a magnificent performance by the women. A wonderful friend of mine who's been gone many years now, historian Tom Bassett at UVM, said of the Vermont women in the Civil War, they enlisted for the duration. And I think he hit it right on the head. Yeah.
Am I right that there's a story of a woman in Vermont enlisting in the Army and going to fight?
There are rumors of this, of a St. Johnsbury woman, of a Danville woman. And my research is still going on. But a couple of researchers at the National Archives say that they have identified a woman from Shaftesbury as having served in a Vermont regiment, enlisting with her husband, passing herself off as a man. Mary Livermore, who was one of the great coordinators of the nursing effort in the Civil War, came to Montpelier after the war, said that there were well more than 400 women in the Northern armies that did this. But this woman and her new husband apparently enlisted in the 14th Vermont, served for 9 months, came home to Shaftesbury, and then moved for the rest of their lives to New Jersey. But 14th Vermont Regiment, if they were in that regiment, she fought at Gettysburg. She fought in the fight to break Pickett's charge. It's amazing. And I'm digging more into this one, but maybe we'll even find more.
That's fascinating. As you do your research, are you finding that women in Vermont at the outset of the war had a more realistic philosophy and attitude about how long this war was going to be and how brutal it was going to be? Because there were a lot of people who thought, hey, this thing's going to be over in a month or 6 weeks. Do we find that a lot of women, they think this is going to be a tough slog?
Absolutely. I mean, suddenly, you know, they're left doing the hard work. They're probably working harder than their husbands, except on days of long marches and battles. Listen to what a Vermont woman says in after her husband's gone to the Army in 1862 and the fighting season is ended. Winter's come on. I suppose before this you heard of General McClellan's removal from office. There seems to be more dissatisfaction with the management of affairs than ever before. The 600,000 men that were going to win the war in double-quick time are going into winter quarters without striking a blow. I tell you, Dutton, when you left home, I thought it might accomplish some good. She's hit it right there. She understands the overall strategy. She's slaving away on this farm. And here he is down there when the Army's losing the war. Oh, yeah. There's a very realistic attitude, and it comes through in the letters and the diaries time and time again.
Let's talk to Pat, who's calling from Fairfield. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. This is great. I appreciate so much this show. I have a question. It's not a comment on the women or anything, but I just remembered a couple of years back, there was a move by Walmart or someone to build and that you were testifying before Congress, I was thinking, I was wondering where that was at.
We stopped that Walmart store. It was going to be on the Wilderness Battlefield in Virginia, where Vermont had what I think is that great moment in the Civil War. They were going to build a huge big box store. The battle went on here in the Vermont legislature and Congress, and the Vermont legislature pitched in, and we stopped that store. It never was built. There's always a fight to preserve battlefields, and that's one that we won, and thank you for asking. I owe a great deal to the legislature and a lot of Vermonters who got involved, too.
Pat, thanks very much for your phone call. We got this email from Ray talking about the preservation of battlefields. I strongly encourage people to go out and see these historic sites, Ray wrote us. A couple of years ago, on the way back from a trip down south, I was able to stop by the Cedar Creek Battlefield, where my great-grandfather and his brother, both in about 16 or 17 years old, fought for the Union in the 8th Vermont Infantry. Nothing quite gives one an appreciation for these people and the events that they participated in as actually walking the grounds. And that is really true, isn't it?
The greatest living Civil War historian is James McPherson of Princeton. And Jim once said, he and I were on a commission together, a dear friend, he once said, you cannot understand a Civil War battle without walking the battlefield. You really can't. And thankfully, many of those battlefields, like Gettysburg, Wilderness, have been pretty well preserved, although the pressures build and build as the population grows.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Naomi, who is calling from Moncton. Hi, Naomi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm calling because there is a long history of women in Europe and certainly during the Civil War cross-dressing and passing as men. And any number of them were not discovered until actually their bodies were being prepared, you know, after they died. So they passed successfully for their, you know, for the entire time they were cross-dressing. So that's not at all unusual, and it would surprise me if there weren't women from Vermont that did cross-dress and fight in the Civil War.
Yes, I have a feeling that if it's possible, you know, when you're looking into an area that's secret, it's difficult to research, but I think we may find more of these, and I'm pretty certain that this woman from Shaftesbury probably is a true story. Thanks for calling, yes.
Let's turn to Roger, who is calling from East Fairfield. Hey, Roger, welcome to the program.
Hello there. Yes, it was about 25 years ago or so. I was working renovations on a building across from the fountain in Taylor Park in St. Albans. In a dark corner of the cellar, we located what looked like a ornate wrought iron bank teller cage leaning up against the wall. And I hypothesized that perhaps someone had saved that as a relic from the St. Albans raid. It may be there still. I don't know.
It could well be. The tellers in those banks kept that memory alive all their lives because they were scared to death that those pistols were going to go off, and particularly when they heard the raiders say that they were out to avenge what Sheridan was doing in the Shenandoah Valley. So it was a scary time.
We were talking about the role of women in Vermont during the Civil War, and you were talking about a lot of them taking care of the farm, doing a lot of the very difficult chores. Some went and worked in factories, and a whole bunch served in military hospitals as well.
Yes, we had three military hospitals in Vermont, Montpelier, Brattleboro, and Burlington. And then more women went off to work in the federal hospitals down around Washington. I learned last week that three women from Verschier. It was tough to get accepted into the federal nurse corps. You had to be over, I think, 35. You couldn't be attractive You had to be plain looking. And qualifications were put in place by Dorothea Dix, who kind of managed the whole thing, and she didn't want pretty young women distracting the soldiers. But by the end of the war, after the Wilderness Campaign, when, you know, casualties reached 80,000, any woman that would work in the hospitals was welcome. Be she a beauty queen. I mean, all these qualifications were dropped by the wayside.
And what happens when the men come back from the war? Is it a difficult adjustment for a lot of the women who have been in leadership positions?
Oh, I think it is. The women basically ran, you know, the local groups that made things for the soldiers. They worked in the factories. They ran the local anti-slavery operations. And suddenly the men come home, heroes, and they take over their places in society, and it will be a long time before the women achieve that status, but next year will be the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, and the Civil War experience had something to do with that, very certainly.
And just briefly, you're doing more research on this subject. Are you thinking about a book or doing just a lot of lectures about it?
Well, I have two unfinished books right now, whether I'll ever get to a book on this one or not. But I'm out there speaking, and I'll be coming your way.
This has been a great discussion. Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin, many thanks for coming by and sharing all of this fascinating information with us.
Always a pleasure, Bob. Wonderful.